Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast for Friday, May 22nd, 2020. My name is Daniel Bader. This week, welcoming you back after a very long time, too long, Ara Wagner. How you doing?
Yes, the last time I was here, the Disney parks were open, and I'm very sad that they're still closed.
Yeah, the world ended between the last time you were here and today, so got a lot to talk about. You're stuck in a city that depends on tourist dollars and Disney, and neither of them are really happening right now.
Well, they reopened Disney Springs this week, and Universal will be opening in like 2 weeks because they're reopening on June 5th because June 7th is the anniversary of Universal Studios Florida. So I think they're rushing their reopening
because of an arbitrary anniversary.
Oh, well, that seems much more important than not dying.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems like a really good idea.
I mean, hopefully they've been closed for 3 months, so I'm sure that they've had plenty of time to figure out what their guidelines are going to be. And at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what the guidelines are going to be because people are going to ignore them.
Well, that rational voice that you hear is Jerry Hildenbrand. Welcome back.
I have never been called rational before. Thank you so much.
Well, there's a lot of firsts on this on this podcast. So I'm glad to be the first first annual Jerry rational comment.
So I only have to do it once a year. I can deal with that.
You only have to be rational once a year.
Yes. Yeah,
exactly. That's easy. All right. So this week we're going to primarily talk about work from home, and in particular, the context of Chromebooks and the rise of Chromebooks in work from home and education, just in like access to cheap computing, because that is a thing that people have needed as work from home has proliferated. And we'll talk a little bit about Huawei and the entity list and TSMC, because that's kind of interesting. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about Pixel 4a. So this week, if you've been following the news, there's been a lot of Pixel 4a news. We were actually expecting the Pixel 4a to launch alongside Android 11 beta, and that was going to happen June 3rd. It got pushed back. And then, well, then John Prosser, Apple leaker extraordinaire, drops a bomb on Twitter a couple of days ago saying, first of all, he tweeted, "Sorry, Sundar," a couple of hours before the tweet actually went live, or the leak went live, which was just the best like tease for what was going to happen. Because he did the same thing when he dropped the Apple Glass leak a week before. And, you know, he's always saying, "Sorry, Tim," but right before he just blasts the doors open with an Apple leak. Anyway, "Sorry, Sundar" was followed up by Pixel 4a was originally May, then got pushed to June, now pushed again. He's looking at July 13th for a current announcement date in two colors, just black and barely blue. 4G only, so no 5G, which is not surprising. And that it appears like Google has the phones ready to ship, but they are just waiting on the right time. He says, I quote, "The decision is mostly based on market analysis," end quote. He did follow up that tweet with some clarifications, just saying that one of the colors will be available in July, or in August, rather. So the actual rollout is going to be August for one of them, and then October somehow for the next one. And that just seems really strange to me that Google doesn't have its stuff together. The black version launches in August and the blue in October. October is when the flagship Pixels usually launch. So I don't know, Ara, this seems like something fishy is going on here with the Pixel release dates.
Yeah, at this point, don't half-ass it with a release that's like, "Oh, we're going to announce in July and we're going to have some of them available in August and some in October." No, screw that. Just launch the phone in October and push the Pixel 5 back to next March or next May. Like, come on, people.
Like, okay, so there's two ways of thinking about this, right? The Pixel 4a could have launched the day after the iPhone SE and been able to be compared head to head. That it would have been a really legit kind of comparison. It would have been the iPhone SE for Android users, blah blah blah, at $399 or even the rumored $349. It just would have been a great deal. The further off from that release it's pushed, the less interesting it is for potential iPhone SE buyers, right? The less interesting it is for people who are thinking about putting the Pixel 4a next to the Galaxy A51, which happens to be the most popular Android phone in Q1, according to Strategy Analytics, against newer entries like the Moto G Stylus, the TCL 10 Pro, all of these $399, $450 phones. And it also extends the life of the Pixel 3a, which right now is available for like $280, which is nuts. But it also, like, it just makes the phone less interesting because it pushes it into late summer, back to school time frame, and it puts pressure on that Pixel 5 launch date. Jerry, is it the right move to potentially make the Pixel A series a summer fall release, and then push the flagship to the following spring when it would compete better with the Galaxy line? The Galaxy S line?
I don't think there's any value in picking the perfect time for the expensive Pixel. Sales are so low that I don't think that would make much of a difference. But getting the A series out closer to holiday shopping, back to school shopping, that makes a whole lot of sense to me. You know, hopefully they can, you know, in their eyes, maybe we can get people to forget that the iPhone SE exists when we dazzle them with this new Pixel and show them the camera, and then they see a price that's even cheaper, and it's right around time to buy phones for your family. You know, that'd be the only thing I could think of.
We don't even know what back to school is going to look like this year, especially if most kids are still stuck home. Which we don't know how many kids are going to be distance learning in the fall when things pick back up. So I don't know if I want to bank on back to school for the Pixel 4a. I do know I would want to bank on having it out and then having it at a good price for Black Friday and the holiday shopping season.
Yeah, if they release it in August, they can knock another $80 off of it for Black Friday. Easily.
Yeah, I guess there's a question of, you know, what's the ideal time frame for any phone release anymore? Does it even matter if you're sort of releasing them just on an annual clip and the year-over-year improvements are fairly minor? I think it's quite interesting just in light of what we learned about how Google's executives saw the Pixel 4 as largely a flop, along with everybody else, basically, and how they're trying to reframe the 4A. Maybe they're waiting a little bit longer so that they can get the margins high enough to release it at $350, right? Knowing that it would sell more. Perhaps it is just a shortage of components, or that the distribution within places like Taiwan is not where it's at. But I don't think that's the concern. The supply chain in Taiwan seems to be back to normal. I've not heard of any component shortages or delays coming out of that particular region. So it does seem like this is just, as Prosser said, a market analysis question. You know, the Pixel 3a hasn't sold in the numbers that Google wanted. So this is just a you know, one of those things where Google's probably just weighing the pros and cons. Now, this comes on sort of the back of an interview that Sundar Pichai gave to The Verge, where he reiterated his commitment to the Pixel line, as he does every time somebody asks him. But it was a pretty generic commitment. It wasn't like, we are going to release a flagship phone and a cheaper phone every year, and we're going to make sure that everybody, you know, knows the Pixel phone line compared to the Galaxy. Like, it was none of that. It was just like, we are committed to the Pixel line as we are to all Google hardware. We have confidence in, or I have confidence in Rick Osterloh to lead the team, blah, blah, blah. And that was about all he said. Do you think that was enough, Ara, or should he have gone into more detail?
I don't really think he needed to go into more detail. We know that Google is still going to make a phone. We don't know if they're going... I don't know. I don't particularly care if Google tries to make a flagship, because after 4 years, I'm really tired of seeing that they can't get battery life right. No amount of camera prowess is worth it if the phone dies by 3 p.m. when I'm in the park and I need to bring a battery pack with me every single time. I like the Pixel 3a because it's something that's affordable. The rest of my family, apart from my little sister, is using a Google Pixel 3a that they bought on either Prime Day or Black Friday. But they bought those because they are cheap, they are going to get updated for at least 3 years, and they work with the Wi-Fi calling in AT&T, which means that they can use Wi-Fi calling in the house.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, that's a very specific thing. But if you look at the larger trends in the market, right, people aren't spending money. They're not really looking to buy expensive phones. But we also know that the Pixel 5 is not going to be the spec powerhouse that the Pixel 4 tried to be. It's not going to compete on speed. It's likely going to give up motion sense as a way to unlock your phone and to manipulate the phone with your hands. So, Jerry, what does this say if, say, the Pixel 5 gets a Snapdragon 765, but it's only released in March of next year? Would Google have to update it to include the 768 that was just announced, or is that phone pretty much set and they're just going to have to ride it out for that cycle and then hopefully do better with the Pixel 6?
Well, first, I want to talk just real quick about what Sundar said in the interview with The Verge. What else can he say? Google could totally burn all its partners and sell 50 million pixels a year if they wanted to. If he come out with a laundry list of, here's why the Pixel phone is better, and, here's where we need to improve, all of Android's partners would really be pissed. And nobody wants that. So that I would never expect anything but fluff when he's asked that question, because it's the only answer he can give. But as far as the If Google would release a phone next year with the Snapdragon 765, that tells me that the Galaxy S20 could have been $100 cheaper and use the 855.
I mean, you've said that many times, but the reality is that companies like Qualcomm don't support older chips as much as they perhaps should. And
but they can.
They can, but they... but so here's the question, right? Google still relies on Qualcomm, like every other manufacturer, basically. And Qualcomm has its business interests of selling new chips, updated chips to OEMs on an annual basis, right?
That's right.
That is their business. Aside from licensing patents, they are in the chip selling business. So, what Google said here is quite interesting. They said, Sundar said, hardware is hard, obviously, and it definitely has components which take real time to get it right, thinking about underlying silicon or display or camera or any of those tacks. And so we are definitely investing in it, but that timeline, I think we've made a lot of progress. And he was just talking about, whether the low Pixel sales have affected the outlook for the Pixel lineup going forward. If you haven't heard that story, go listen to last week's episode. We talk a lot about that. But he carries on, we take a long-term view. We are not in it just for phones alone. We have a vision of where computing needs to go, and I think it's really hard to drive that vision without doing hardware, software, and services together. You have to think of the intersection of it. I see a lot of value in thinking about it and doing it that way. So really, what he's saying is that phones are just one small component of their larger portfolio of hardware. And it's not as important to Google as it is to Samsung, right? Right. The Pixel phone line is not as important to Google as the Galaxy brand and line of phones is to Samsung. It never will be. And to think differently would be foolish. And if you get your head around that, maybe it's okay that Google's only selling, you know, 6-8 million units a year. Does that justify it almost?
I don't know if it justifies it, but we know with the Pixel 1 and the Pixel 2, Google was really happy selling 6-8 million phones. That overshot their projections. They were fine with that. And, you know, the media, we all said that Google's ramping things up. They're going to get serious about selling phones. Maybe they didn't. Maybe selling 5 million is good enough because all they do is they're pulling a Sony or an LG and they want to offer a phone for the people that want one, but they're not really looking to make a big profit from phone sales.
Right.
So, yeah, that makes sense to me. I don't think it's the right call, but I don't have any say in it. And I'm maybe not the best financial mind in the world. To Google, it's the right call right now, apparently. So, I don't know. It seems weird, but they know what they're doing, I guess.
All right. I mean, this kind of moves us in the direction of what we wanted to talk about today with Chromebooks, right? Google has been accused of sort of sitting on its laurels and not really innovating in the Chrome OS space. But this last few weeks has seen a massive increase in the interest in Chromebooks as a platform, not just from Google as a hardware vendor, which only makes two Chromebooks.
Three.
Which one?
They make three. They make the Pixel Slate, the Pixel Book, and the Pixel Go. The slate isn't a complete piece of crap anymore, man.
All right, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it because you reviewed one of the other tablets, the only other tablet in the Chrome OS space that people should care about. But anyway, there's just been a ton of interest in low cost computing in general over the last few months since work from home, since kids started going to school at home. Not all of the school districts offer Chromebooks for their students to take home for many reasons, socioeconomic and otherwise. And a lot of students have just been clamoring to get their hands on anything. So you, who covers Chromebooks and Chrome OS for Android Central, what's your take on just this momentous sea change in how people view Chromebooks as a platform?
I don't really think it's that momentous in that Chromebooks have been slowly taking over classrooms and enterprise for the last 5 years, especially over the last 18 months or so. Chromebooks have been getting more and more attention. Chromebooks have proven themselves to be able to, they do what you need them to do. They're easy for school districts to manage. They're easy for employers to lock down so that way people don't abuse them. And you can find them relatively affordably, especially when you're purchasing in bulk for a business or for a school. If you got to buy 500 computers for your kids, Chromebooks are probably your best bet right now, especially considering if you go the iPad route, you're probably paying $250 per unit, even with an educational discount, and then you have to buy a keyboard and a case and all of that. For a Chromebook, Chromebook comes with a keyboard. Chromebook has great battery life, and the Chromebook's going to get updated for probably 5-6 years. So if you buy a Chromebook for a student, it'll last them from 8th grade till they graduate high school.
That's actually a really interesting way of putting it. Now, would you want to use the same $300 Chromebook for 5 years is the question.
I still like my Lenovo 330. Yeah, I mean, it's a lightweight operating system. It doesn't get bogged down over time the way that other machines do. Like, before I had the Lenovo C330, before I had my Pixelbook, I had this old Lenovo Yoga ThinkPad, whatever the heck it was called. But I used that sucker for a good three years from whenever Jerry sent it to me. And it never really slowed down. It was the computer I could depend on. And it was durable as heck. I could just throw it in my bag and take it with me to work or just use it around the house. Didn't matter what I was around. Didn't matter how big or how small my workspace was. it fit and it worked. And it had a touchscreen and Android apps. So that was all I really needed.
I think Era, back me up here. When you take a Chromebook out of the box, it's either capable or barely capable. If it's capable when you take it out, it's going to be capable years from now.
Yep. Basically, the only thing that could maybe start getting long in tooth would be your memory further down the line. Because, I mean, Chromebooks with 2 gigabytes of RAM were in the barely capable category a year and a half ago. But 2 years ago, a 2 gigabyte Chromebook could still maybe hold its own. 4 gigabyte is, and that's where 4 gigabytes is probably going to be in 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, you're going to need to open less tabs in the browser and, you know, be mindful if you try to install a big Android game.
But we're also talking about a platform that has traditionally outpaced its rivals in terms of its ability to run on cheaper hardware with less RAM, right? Like back when when Windows and Mac OS laptops needed 4 gigs or 8 gigs, Chromebooks were okay with 2 gigs and 4 gigs. And that seems to be the case today. I mean, you could buy a Surface Book 3 with 32 gigabytes of RAM. I think the highest spec Pixel Book is 16 gigs, and nobody's ever pretended that you need 16 gigs of RAM on a Chromebook, not even for really intensive tasks.
No, not even for like Linux apps do you need more than 8. And even then, that's if you're only trying to do like the really intensive stuff.
I have 8 gigabytes in my Pixel Book, and I use it for C++ compilation through a Linux set of apps. It's hard to describe, but the chain I use to compile software is done in Linux, and 8 gigabytes, it's still sitting there with 2 to 3 empty, just like it always should, empty and ready to go.
Yep.
Okay, so let's talk about the, you know, you said it's not momentous because Chromebooks have taken over the education space, but what is it about them right now that makes them so popular, in fact, that you can't even buy one? There are so few models available on Amazon and elsewhere that it just feels like one of those perfect storms, right? Everything happened at once to make Chromebooks incredibly, incredibly, the perfect computer for this particular period.
When we were on the briefing call for HP, when they announced their latest round of enterprise Chromebooks, they had one client that purchased and deployed 60,000 Chromebooks over a span of like 3 weeks, which is something you wouldn't really ever hear of being possible with Windows computers because they just take so much time to get them all imaged, get them all set up with all the software, get everything ready to go on them, and then get people logged into them. Chromebooks is you buy them, you set up your Google Enterprise, whatever, and the moment they take the Chromebook out of the box and log in with their Enterprise account, everything's ready to go.
That is really interesting. 60,000. Holy crap.
Yeah, no, that was one bank in Australia.
But to set up 60,000 Chromebooks, one administrator sets up the Google Apps account the way he wants it. And then when 60,000 users get their Chromebook and sign in, it's done. That's the advantage. And that's why a lot of schools and businesses use Chromebooks, not because they're capable or necessarily cheap, but because they're so easy to administer. You can administer every user without having to touch their machine. And yes, you can do that in Windows after you've set everything up. But with a Chromebook, there's just no setup for the user. They just sign in.
So, Ara, there's this new breed of more expensive, more powerful Chromebooks that have cropped up this year.
Project Athena Chromebooks, yes. They made a big splash at CES, but then they came this spring. And I will say, battery life on the 436 has actually improved over the last couple of Chrome OS updates. So that might have been some wonk during the launch and during our review periods, because I'm now getting, instead of getting like 6 to 7.5 hours of battery life, I'm now getting from like 8 to maybe 9.5, which is what I would more expect from a $1,000 Chromebook.
Go back just a second. So what do you mean when you talk about Project Athena for people who don't know?
Project Athena is a certification that I believe Google and Intel worked on in order to have a set of specifications. That way, if you get a Project Athena certified Chromebook, it's going to have X, Y. It's going, you know, it's going to be powerful. You know, it's going to be stable, and you know, it's going to be secure. Because I believe most, if not all, of the Project Athena Chromebooks have a fingerprint sensor in them for biometric security. They all have an Intel, either an i5 or an i7, Jerry? Was the minimum i3 or i5?
I'm not sure, Era. I'm really not sure.
But they're, long story short, if it's a Project Athena Chromebook, it's going to be a very powerful, long-lasting machine.
Right, they're, because Intel and Google actually worked on specific power management through Chrome OS to, you know, help make sure the CPU is running at the right frequency whenever it needs to. So that made a big difference in battery life for a lot of things.
Okay, so that's one thing. And Project Athena is not specific to Chrome. It applies right to Windows laptops as right well, but it's benefiting Chromebooks for those same reasons, right? The fact that newer Intel chips are easier on the battery, that there's sort of this inline marriage of software and hardware optimizing battery life, especially idle battery life. So mm-hmm. you're not just going to sit there and wake up to a dead computer. There were a couple of big releases. As you said, the Galaxy Chromebook was announced at CES, the Acer Chromebook 715, the Asus Chromebook Flip C436. What is the big deal about these? What makes these important in the narrative of Chromebooks, especially at the high end?
Before I get into that, Acer 715 was not Project Athena and was not CES. That was pre-CES. But it's still a good Chromebook, and I need to review it soon. But for Project Athena, for all these powerful Chromebooks we saw at CES, the powerful, like the big, beefy workhorse Chromebooks, for a long time, your only real mainstream option was the Pixel line. You had a Pixel, you had the Pixelbook, or then you had the Pixelbook Go. There were some powerful Chromebooks that came out from Lenovo, from Dell, and HP. They built some really powerful Chromebooks, but then they just weren't really widely available. So it's nice to see that we're getting good high-end Chromebook options from more than just Google these days.
And that's important because it puts, like with flagships versus budget phones, it puts the it gives customers the choice, and it opens up these use cases for Chromebooks that may not have been there before. Now, the Chromebook, Galaxy Chromebook, rather, was pretty mediocrely reviewed, I would say. Yep. A lot of people said that it had great performance, it had a decent screen, the stylus in the body was a nice addition, but that the battery life was just kind of garbage.
A Chromebook with 6 hour battery life or less is kind of a failure, especially when you have the $200-$300 Chromebooks that'll eke out 10 to 12 hours of battery life. Like right. I have the Duet here, and I'm going to get 12 to 14 hours of screen time on this tablet before I need to plug it in again.
Let's just talk quickly about, like, if somebody is in the market for a higher end laptop today, should they be thinking about buying a higher end Chromebook over a Windows or Mac, or are they still very much separate?
It depends what you're trying to do with your laptop. Like everything, it depends on your use case. If you're somebody who likes to game, a Chromebook is still not a great option, and just unless you just absolutely love Stadia, and Stadia just doesn't have a whole lot of games right now, because we still don't have Steam is technically supported on Chrome OS thanks to Linux applications, but we still don't have the good GPU integration that we need in order to properly game on a Chromebook, apart from Android gaming, which I'm more than happy to do on a Chromebook because all I want to do is play FreeCell.
Yeah, I don't think FreeCell takes up, taxes the specs of buying Chromebook very much.
FreeCell leagues, that's just not a thing.
No. But it should be. At the same time, though, if you're trying to do anything that involves like high, if you do high-end video editing, or if you high-performance 3D rendering, you're still probably going to want to use a Windows or a Mac. But if you're just wanting to, I want a good computer, but all I'm going to really be doing with it is watching live streams, typing, surfing social media, researching stuff, paying my bills, and video chatting with my friends and family. All you really need is an Asus C34 if you can find one, or the Asus 436 is great. I really want it to come down in price about $200 before I really want to start pushing it hard on consumers, because it's really hard to push a $1,000 Chromebook in this environment. But it is a beautiful machine and is going to be supported for several years to come.
Talk about the Chromebook Duet, because that's kind of in the opposite direction. It's yes. $300 or $280 if you buy it from Lenovo directly. It's a tablet with an attachable keyboard, and it sort of brings us back to that Google, you know, Pixelbook Slate conversation, but at a much lower price point. And yet you gave it 4.5 stars out of 5, and you recommend it highly. So why this but not the Slate? Even though you like the Slate, but we don't count that.
I do.
The Slate failed at launch because it had software issues. And to be fair, tablet mode is still not 100% on the Duet. There's like that 1% where it'll flake out between when you're switching from vertical to horizontal while you're in tablet mode sometimes with Android apps. But other than that, tablet mode is finally working on Chrome OS, which I am so grateful to hear, because we just didn't really have things optimized properly when the Slate came out, which is why everybody panned it and was right to do so. The other big lesson that Lenovo and Google learned from the Pixel Slate and didn't do with the Duet is they decided to include everything in the box. It isn't, oh, you need to spend $300 on the tablet and then spend another $150 on the keyboard and another $100 on the kickstand case. No, that all is in the box. Which is great, because that means that all you need to do is pick up, you just need to buy this one unit, and you have everything you need to get going.
I want to say something to everybody who's listening out there. Era or myself, we would love the Chromebook Duet. Era reviewed it. She loved it. Daniel would hate it. He would give it 1 star. If you aren't used to Chrome's quirks, and I ran into this with the Pixel Slate. I love the Pixel Slate. There was some software weirdness, but it's Chrome weirdness. Era and I are used to Chrome weirdness. We don't get turned off by Chrome weirdness.
We're so used to Chrome weirdness that we forget that it's
we don't
Chrome.
Mind working around, oh, well, you should just be able to swipe. No, you can't swipe. You have to tap, you know, to move through a page of apps or something. We're used to that, and we're okay with that, but you might not be. So you have to remember that, you know, Chrome is still Chrome. And even if it's much better, you may not like it. And I always want to tell everybody that whenever they're thinking about buying a Chromebook.
And it helps that for most of the Chromebooks that I recommend, I like recommending the quote-unquote mid-range of Chromebooks, which is the $300 Chromebooks, that you're not going to be out a whole lot of money if you don't like it. And it's still a good, lightweight computer that even if it's not powerful enough for you, and even if you don't necessarily like it, it's still a good computer to have around for your kids could use it, your grandparents could use it, because it's easy to learn. Like, Chrome OS was designed around, okay, we need something that if this is somebody's first computer, they will be able to understand it quickly.
I kind of agree with you that I wouldn't have as much patience for a tablet mode. I didn't have a lot of patience for the Pixelbook Slate in tablet mode. I'm happy that Google tried to address Chrome OS's limitations in tablet mode, but it spoke volumes that they gave up on the actual form factor internally. I think it was a mistake to abandon ship as quickly as they did and leave it in the hands of partners like Lenovo. I understand that the Chrome OS team is not the same as Rick Osterloh's hardware team, right? And that Rick Osterloh's team gave up on building tablets as opposed to Chrome OS gave up on iterating on tablet mode within Chrome OS, and that's an important distinction. But that messaging was failed miserably, right? Because that is not apparent to most people. And I bet you that if you've been following the narrative around Chrome OS on tablets, you're going to think twice about buying the Duet because of that, if you've heard anything.
And maybe you should, because that was a huge mistake on Google's part. I think the hardware team giving up and the software team giving up have to have been tied together somehow. You know, I'm not privy to any details like that, but...
The software team didn't give up, though. The Chrome OS team has never given up on tablet mode for Chromebooks because it's been improving for every two-in-one that we've had on the market for the last 5 years.
They're no longer trying to innovate. They're trying to fix those Chrome weird things that you and I can put up with. That's really all they're trying to do.
Right, but here's the other thing is... Last week, we talked about the Pixel line being necessary, not just for consumers, but as a reference device for developers, mm-hmm. right? And there is the same argument to be made for something like the Slate.
Absolutely. Right?
And it would have been a reference device and potentially is because it's not discontinued. It's still being sold. But that same argument applies to Chrome on tablets. And the issue is that Google has again and again dipped its toe into tablet as a form factor and then removed it once it got cold. And that is a problem
yep.
for any developer on Android or Chrome or both that wants to build for this very, very important, even if it's, the market share isn't massive, it's still a very important form factor. And it's something that Apple seems to have figured out and increasingly Microsoft is figuring out, right? Jerry, you wrote this really good piece this week comparing Chrome OS to Windows 10X of what we know about Windows 10X.
Yep.
Windows 10X is now becoming a single screen tablet optimized operating system before it becomes a dual screen optimized operating system. And I think that is really, it just speaks volumes, right? Google does not know, even if it is improving tablet mode, it doesn't know how to tell that story to consumers. And Ara, I think you'd agree there that that's the main issue here.
It is. If Google were the one that had to go out and sell all of these themselves. We're lucky that Lenovo is going to do that for them, and Lenovo has done a damn better job at doing that than Google has over the last 3 years, especially with the C340 and the C330 before it. Lenovo has learned how to make a Chromebook that will apply to the masses, and they've turned that to a tablet that will apply that will appeal to the masses as well. I'm more hopeful for this than I was for the Slate at any point in its life cycle so far.
Oh, this will be a better for most people than the Slate because of the price. I mean, that's really all there is to it. Because Lenovo can tweak the form factor to make it a really great and easy to use device. Yet they still depend on Google for the software. And Microsoft, they learned. Man, remember Windows 8? Microsoft learned that people hate what people really, really hate, and that you can't take an operating system and say, hey, let's just make it touch-friendly and go, and you can use it on anything. And it was such a failure that they stopped and they revamped. They took a couple years. Then they started to work changes in, and now we finally have the culmination of all those couple years of hard work with Windows 10X. We think that it's going to be a whole lot better, you know, for any device with a touch screen, or and especially devices with a convertible form factor. Where you go to the flip side, you've got Google, who just wants to try to make Chrome more touch friendly without, I hate to use the word courage, the courage maybe to just revamp everything. And I think that's what it's going to take is, all right, enough. This just doesn't work. There's no way you can make this mouse and keyboard driven operating system touch friendly in this way. So let's just revamp how this works. And I think that's really what it's going to take. They're going to have to copy Microsoft here.
Okay, Ara, I want you to talk about just using the Duet, right? Talk about from beginning to end as a laptop, as a tablet, as a hybrid. What's the experience like on a day-to-day basis?
I used it full time for a week and a half while I was writing the review, and I'm still using it about 30 to 40% of the time right now. I'm using it to reference articles while we're sitting here talking about Chromebooks. It's lightweight, it's easy to use. The screen, I will admit, 10.1 inches feels small to me because I'm used to using an 11.6 inch screen. And even losing that extra inch and a half, you feel it at that small size. So I will say that for some people who are used to a bigger screen, the Duet isn't going to be for you, because even though you can do display out to a second display, the display out capabilities on the Duet are less powerful than they are on most of the $300 Chromebooks that you would encounter. Because it tops out at 1080p, 30 hertz. And since most monitors won't do 30 hertz, it'll kick it down even further to 720p, 60 hertz.
When you're in tablet mode, I mean, we kind of know the deal with laptop mode, but when we're in tablet mode, what does that feel like today? What's it like using the combination of Chrome browser, Chrome extensions and Android apps? Are you using any of those, and how do they all tie together in tablet mode right now?
When I'm in tablet mode, I am usually sitting on the couch doing more of a just like I'm like casually browsing through Twitter or Reddit, or I'm playing Free Solo, or I'm reading comics, or I'm reading something. I use it more as for constant consumption when I ditch the keyboard. Although I will say, sometimes when I'm in tablet mode, I will go and plug in at my standing desk and use it with a full mechanical keyboard, just because Chrome OS is still built for the keyboard and mouse, and it's just way easier to type when you're not using an on-screen keyboard.
You really hit on something there, Era. And I think you're going to agree that the Chrome browser, not Chrome OS itself, the browser and plenty of Android apps, they're great for a touchscreen only device. But the operating system itself still needs a ton of work.
Expand on that.
Little things. The app drawer in tablet mode, just, it kills me. There is a built-in purpose pause. You cannot scroll through the
what
app
do you mean?
Screen. You can't scroll.
Yeah, you can.
Page.
I'm doing it right now.
But it's paginated. You go from page to page.
Yes.
That's dumb. It's just a list of apps.
Jerry, I want full-blown Android launchers on Chrome OS tablets as much as the next person, but even a lot of Android launchers use a paginated scroll instead of having it be one big list.
But the only tablet that's worth buying right now doesn't. It's you if you buy an iPad, you swipe from screen to screen just like you do on a phone. That's what people are used to. That is an expected behavior. I don't like it. You like it. That's all subjective, but what's expected is not what you get. You go through the settings. You can tap everything and make it work, but touch targets seem to be in the wrong place, or you think you should be able to tap here and make something happen, but you can't. You have to tap at the edge of a block where there should be a visible cue. The operating system itself still needs a lot of work to be touch friendly. The content it can display is almost there, but not the shell around it.
I don't know if the content is there either. You know, like using an Android app on Chrome just doesn't. Most of them are still sort of in this weird hybrid world where they haven't explicitly been optimized for the aspect ratio. Many of them don't work really well in landscape by default, and although that's not necessarily unique to Chrome, it applies to iOS as well.
They work the same as they do on an Android tablet. Let's put it that way.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's the real failure for Google right now, is that they have made it so easy for developers to just be like, okay, we're just developing for a phone and that's it. There's no point in developing things to where they look good on a tablet too. Or if we have a tablet, layout, we're just stealing the one from our iPad app. That's it. Which is insane, because you should, because Android apps have been able to be adaptive to screen size and even to a resizing window for years between pop-up, between the picture-in-picture and other aspect, or in multi-window. This should not be this hard.
And that's interesting, actually, because, you know, we haven't really heard a lot about Android on tablets in the last couple of years either. We don't really hear about it.
Well, who's making one worth a damn besides Samsung?
Right, but that's like, that is the most, that's basically forking Android, if you as close to forking Android as you're going to get within the GMS world.
Agreed.
You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not just talking about DeX, right? Like, DeX is its own thing, but just Samsung's tablet interface looks nothing like Android, which is probably good because, as you said, it's as close to usable as you get with an Android tablet.
You take that a step further, Samsung's own apps. Mm-hmm. I just looked at the Galaxy S6 earlier this year or late last year. Their Tab S6. It's a Samsung's mail app, for example, or Samsung's messaging app. It looks beautiful. But then when you try Androids, it looks like any other tablet app. Other than Gmail, Android apps aren't even tablet optimized.
Apart from maybe YouTube, because YouTube was meant for tablets.
Right, right. But that's a problem that I don't see ever going away. Google just doesn't care about tablets.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, Google didn't abandon Chrome OS tablets. Google abandoned Android tablets, and that was even worse for Chrome OS because that meant that Android apps were going to be a second class experience unless you pestered the developer long enough to have them update it. Like, the only apps I see being optimized for Chromebooks are education apps and productivity apps, because that's what teachers want and that's what business clients want.
And let's give credit where credit is due. The Chrome browser team has done an excellent job.
Yes.
Making an app for the phone, for tablets, and the Chrome OS version of the browser, as well as Mac and Windows. They've done a great job making it work everywhere, even if it eats too much RAM on your MacBook.
Now, there have been rumors that Google was working on a so-called desktop mode for Android for many years. There was a hidden desktop mode in Android 10 that you could activate over ADB. There appears to be a similar, slightly updated version of desktop mode in Android 11's developer previews. Now, there's nothing stopping Google from, you know, using its resizing APIs to build a functioning desktop mode for all of Android, right? Just to roll it out to AOSP. But it does seem like there's no interest in that because there's so much, there just doesn't seem to be any reason to do it, right? And we're talking about desktop mode on phones when you plug it in to a larger display.
Well, let's first be real about something. When was the last time you plugged your phone in for anything other than charging?
Right, but I'm saying this could benefit tablets because, look, Google's not going to make a Pixel tablet anytime soon, but them iterating on a desktop mode is similar to what they do with their Pixel phones, where if they do something that's a best practice for Android in general, it rolls out usually to other manufacturers. And with the rise of foldable phones having larger displays that are operating much more like tablets than ever before, Google could be better able to inform companies like Samsung and, I guess, Huawei or other manufacturers that are building tablets within their phones using foldable displays.
Like Pablo Escobar.
Here's how to resize an app properly. Here's how to make them reform. Here's how to, here's how to share data between them more securely, right? Samsung is working with Google on this stuff, but it would benefit, I think, the entire ecosystem for Google to be a bit louder about their intentions. And that's all I mean.
Right now, an Android desktop. If you're using a Windows or a Mac machine right now and you get a message pop up from, say, Slack or any other toast message, imagine if you expanded that full screen and it was 90% blank space with a little bit of text in the middle. That's what an Android desktop is going to look like, because it's all apps built for a phone. And when you resize them, boy, it resizes just fine. but the content doesn't flow. And you're left with just a little bit of content and a whole bunch of empty space. That's going to be an Android desktop mode. I guess it's smart for Google to always be working on things, but don't expect that to be the, oh, one more thing when they announce, you know, officially announce Android 11.
If it took them 5 years to get dark mode back into Android, it's going to take 10 for them to get a desktop mode worth anything.
If they're going to do it at all, which I don't think they will.
I'm really hard on Google a lot, and I think people who listen to this podcast or read anything I've written have seen me be really hard on Google. That's because I think they've got some of the smartest people in the world there, and they're capable of better. But this isn't easy. This is trying to make one set of software that works across 260 some odd different brands of hardware manufacturers, each wanting to do their own thing. That makes this very difficult. So while I'm hard on you, Google, I still respect what you're doing. I couldn't do it.
You mean you couldn't do the equivalent of a massive multi, you know, near trillion-dollar company with thousands of engineers?
No, we would all just take Fridays off and get ripped and play PlayStation or something.
I'm betting you that's what most Google engineers are doing these days anyway, because they're all working from home.
For one final note for Android tablets versus the Chromebook Duet, the main reason that Chromebook tablets aren't really worth buying is they're not great out the gate and they're never going to get updated. And that's part of why I'm so happy with the Duet, because I know it's going to get updates every 6 weeks and it's going to get updated until 2028. So that's something I can look at and be like, okay, that's a tablet that I know is going to get security patches the way it needs to. It's going to get feature updates the way it needs to. So even if it's not perfect today, it will get better.
What are the chances we'll be out of lockdown by 2028, Ara?
Oh, God, let's hope so. Vaccines should be available in 2 years.
Oh, my God. It's only been 2 months. I can't deal with this anymore. All right.
It's been 3 months.
Has it been three? Oh, you're right. It has been. No, it hasn't. Mid-March, so mid-May. That's 2 months. It's been like 9 weeks. It's not as much time as you think. It just feels like 3 months. Oh, man. Anyway.
Making it sound bigger helps me rationalize how long it has felt.
Well, I'm jealous of the fact that you get to go pick strawberries in May, because that's just not fair. We're going to have to wait until like June, July for that here.
I all but guarantee you there is somewhere near you that offers it.
No, I do. I know there is, but not until June or July, because they don't start growing here until 2 months after you.
Yeah, you have that 3 week where the ground isn't frozen.
3 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, everything has to grow in that little small window.
I'm not even joking you. This was the first week that I could go outside without a sweater. It's just ridiculous. Anyway, I don't want to get into it. It's too depressing. All right, I want to talk quickly about... All right, sorry, are you done with Chromebooks? You got it all out of your system? One second. Which Chromebook would you recommend? If somebody just wants a good Chromebook right now, which would you recommend to somebody?
Lenovo C340, if you can get it, or basically any of the Chromebooks released in the last year that use the Celeron N4000, 48 gigabytes of RAM, 64 gigabytes of storage, if you can get it.
4 gigs minimum. You shouldn't buy a Chromebook with 2 gigabytes.
There are very few Chromebooks left being sold with 2 gigabytes of RAM.
Oh, that's good to know.
And a touchscreen. Make sure you don't buy.
Yes. Thank you.
Don't save that $30 by buying the non-touchscreen model or you'll hate yourself.
Always buy the touchscreen model. Buy a 2-in-1 if you can. Tablet
mode
is nice.
Should you buy a Chromebook tablet? Should you buy a Duet?
So long as it's not going to be your primary computer, yeah.
Should you buy it over an iPad or some other Windows? Like, is it functional as like an entertainment device?
Yeah. I've read comics on it for 12 hours. I spent all Saturday, like a week or two ago after it first got in, I spent the entirety of Saturday in bed reading fan fiction on that tablet. It works as a content consumption device.
What comics are you reading?
I was rereading Batman No Man's Land.
Wow.
So should I buy an iPad Pro or 11 Chromebook Duets?
I think 11 Chromebook Duets, because then you can go and make like 10 of your family members happy.
Never have to charge the battery. Just grab a new one off the shelf.
There you go.
Battery has been freaking amazing on this thing. Really. I got my review unit in on, like, I want to say it was either Thursday at noon or Friday at noon, and I didn't have to charge it until Monday, at the end of the day Monday.
Well, you know, this is all good news. There are better yep. Chromebooks today than there ever have been before. So if you've been interested in looking at buying one, go do it if you can find one.
If you can find one, which is not easy right now.
All right, so we're going to end the show talking about Huawei, as we've want to do for the last little bit. Huawei is in even more trouble now. Basically, the entity list, the trade ban entity list placement was extended for another year a few weeks ago. And now it is basically going to be amending the rule that allows Huawei to work with semiconductor providers that have a direct relationship with U.S. vendors, specifically TSMC, which is a Taiwanese-based semiconductor company. It builds almost all of Huawei's SoCs, will no longer be allowed to work with Huawei directly until it gets an exemption license from the Commerce Department. And it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. So what happened last week was that TSMC announced that it has stopped taking new orders from Huawei based on that rule change, and that Huawei will now have to basically scramble to find an alternative fab to build its new, its upcoming chips. Now, China, for all of its innovation in the semiconductor design business, right, does not necessarily have a huge infrastructure when it comes to building these chips. There is one company, Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation, or SMIC, that has built some of Huawei's lower-end high silicon Kirin chips, but nothing in the latest generation, not the Kirin 980 that goes in the P40 and Mate 30. So Huawei is kind of stuck scrambling to find another fab that will build its chips. And this story is just insane to me because, like, basically Huawei wasn't allowed to put Google services on its phones, but it could still do pretty much everything else with Android. It could still build the phones themselves. Now, Jerry, there seems to be yet another roadblock, and this could really be the death knell that this company's, not only its phone division, its cloud computing division, its network equipment division, they all rely on Kirin processors in them. What happens now?
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, the Chinese government invests in SMIC, and Huawei can't build or can't get any microchips or controllers for a year. But then next year, all fabrication is done in China. Huawei comes back and sells, a half a billion phones in China. And China turns around and puts tariffs on things like resistors and LEDs and diodes. And we lose. Citizens of the West are the ones who lose, the U.S. specifically. This was the stupidest move I've ever seen anybody make. I don't have any type of finance background. And it was just instantly I saw how this is going to backfire. China will make sure they prop Huawei up.
Well, they are. I mean, yes. We know this, right? And there's going to be retaliation.
We know that China is more than willing to maybe take funding away from other socioeconomic areas and invest in something like semiconductor manufacturing. So SMIC is going to, I would almost guarantee there are blueprints being made for newer and bigger factories that can handle an increased workload. And, Huawei's going to be down for a year, but they're definitely not out.
Yeah. So the Chinese government, Harish wrote a really interesting piece on AC called Losing Huawei. Losing access to TSMC would be catastrophic for Huawei. And he points out that SMIC has just finalized its 14-nanometer FinFET fabrication process, whereas TSMC is right now, and TSMC and Samsung are doing 7-nanometer, and they're looking at 5-nanometer.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, the current slate of Qualcomm, high silicon, even Exynos chips are on 7 or 8-nanometer processes. 5-nanometer is probably going to happen in the next year or two, and SMIC just won't be able to skip those milestones. Without massive investment,
right.
But just engine, like you just have to completely redesign your fab. And it feels like if Huawei cannot develop its high silicon chips or its Kirin chips for a couple of years, they're just going to be way behind. They're going to have to sit on those chip designs. They're not going to be able to iterate on them. They're not going to be able to build them. And they're just going to fall even further behind than they are today. We know that sales outside of China dropped dramatically for Huawei
mm-hmm.
in Q2. And the Chinese market is just not making up the difference.
I don't think it's going to take 1 to 2 years. I think that SMIC could be ready to fab 7-nanometer chips in 8 months. You'd be amazed how fast things can happen when you have a workforce the size of China.
Yeah. I mean, when you say the word, like you normally use it as a simile, like as big as China, workforce as big as China. This is literally what we're talking about
right,
here, though.
Because China won't be afraid to pull people off of one job and get them into another. These factories are going to be built quickly, staffed quickly, and Huawei is going to be right there through the whole process, helping design the equipment to make better chips.
I'm really interested in seeing how this plays out. You know, I've been messing around with the P40 Pro. It's a fantastic phone for all of its flaws, and I just wonder what drama is going to hit Huawei next. This seems like such a bitter pill to swallow, but. Yeah, you're right. This is not going to be the end of Huawei in any way, shape, or form.
We have to hope as consumers that this doesn't turn into something even more petty than it is now, because China could potentially, put Qualcomm out of business if they wanted to. They could make the cost of those tiny components that go inside an SoC so prohibitively expensive that Qualcomm just couldn't afford to make them. I don't think they will, because that affects the Chinese economy. You know, they make them that expensive, they can no longer sell them. But they could, and I hope it doesn't digress that much.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, every other Chinese manufacturer uses Qualcomm chips.
Yep.
So it's not in China's best interest to do that, or to put pressure on Qualcomm as a company rather than just the U.S. government in general.
Qualcomm as an example there. Volkswagen, they use thin film resistors in their cars, and if resistor costs go up 1,000%, you know, all the little electronic parts, their cost just increased, which means that a Volkswagen's cost has to go way up, and that means nobody's buying them anymore. So it's not just smartphones or chip manufacturers. It's that Qualcomm would affect the Chinese bottom line the most.
Yeah, I mean, that's we're going to hear next week, just kind of parallel to this, we're going to hear next week whether the Chinese CFO Meng Wanzhou will be extradited to the U.S. from Canada. The announcement is supposed to happen next Wednesday. So if that happens, you can be sure that's there will be some serious repercussions from the Chinese government as a result.
Yeah, I hope we don't go to war over smartphones.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be, I was going to say it wouldn't be the first time. It wouldn't surprise me.
It wouldn't be the most petty thing we've ever gone to war for, but it would be very, very close. And seriously, how petty is this at this point?
Well, it's not petty if you take the government's words at face value that Huawei is a security risk. But if you don't believe that, then yes, it is petty.
To be fair, I think Huawei is a security risk when it comes to networking infrastructure in secure government facilities. I will give our government that fact.
Yes,
we don't know the details.
But this isn't about their networking
right
business.
Well, it is to some extent because these Kirin chips go into that networking equipment. It just has the side effect of basically killing their smartphone division.
No. This goes into their networking business. The last 18 months, not so much. The last 18 months of this nonsense has mostly been, how can we hurt Huawei so that we hurt their networking business as a result, as a side effect?
Right.
Instead of just trusting other countries to not use their equipment. Like, how hard would it have been to trust the international community 18 months ago and avoid all of this nonsense?
But some companies didn't ban Huawei. I mean, some countries didn't ban Huawei, you know?
Which means us banning them is pointless. What, are we not going to communicate securely with Great Britain or Germany anymore? No, well, of course we are.
Or Canada.
Canada hasn't made that decision yet either, and that's been a point of contention. So, yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see what some countries decide, including Canada. All right, we're going to end it there because we've already gone long. But this was a really cool, fascinating discussion. I really appreciate it. Ara, where can people find you if they want to learn more about you on the interwebs?
Twitter is where I'm most active because I'm mostly a lurker on Reddit. Twitter at Ara Wagco, ARAWAGCO.
Perfect. And Jerry, what are you up to on Twitter these days?
Just poorly photoshopped images and, you know.
I saw that. That was amazing.
Just random stuff. I probably shouldn't. I separate work from Twitter. If I see something cool that we do or, you know, Android Police does or something, I'll share it because I think it's cool. But Twitter is a playground to me. So if you do end up following me, please don't be offended if I post stupid pictures of monkeys or of my bird or just random dumb things that I've done because that's mostly what I do.
In fact, that's Twitter.
Random dumb things is mostly what I do, so I guess it kind of works out.
And yet you stay employed, so you must be doing something right. You're doing well. All right, where can people find you on Twitter? What's your handle?
At GB Hill, and that's GBHIL.
Amazing.
And that is my gamer tag on all things gamer, except
what are you playing right now?
Right now, you're going to embarrass me. The Sims 4.
Why is that embarrassing?
I've decided that I'm going to drown every resident in every neighborhood in a pool.
That's horrifying.
Yeah, well, it's fun, too. It's just cartoons. They're not real people.
As I was saying, Jerry, that's no more embarrassing than the fact that the only games that I play are Microsoft Solitaire Collection, Disney Emoji Blitz, and Disney Sorcerer's Arena.
I think I saw a headline today that 35 million people are still playing Solitaire. Solitaire.
Crap, that's today. Yeah, they're trying to break a world record. I need to go log in and do some of that.
Oh my God. All right, well, you go do that. You can find me at Journey Dan. I'm only playing Tetris 99 on the Switch because I'm so bad at it, and I refuse to be bad at Tetris because I grew up being really good at Tetris, so it hurts my brain. You can find me at Journey Dan on all the things. You can find us all at Android Central, and we love to hear your feedback of the show. Podcast at Android Central. I want to give a quick shout out to Albert. Thank you so much for listening every week. Thank you for the email. I really appreciate it. And we will talk to you next week on the Android Central podcast. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Adios.